This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElroy.
Yeah, once again we've been scouring Scotland for all the best stories, the ones that news people never get and listen to us and envy and say, why did we miss that story?
Why did we miss that? Why didn't we go there? I'll tell you somewhere I did go and you would know it, actually, just outside Gifford. Just the other side of the golf course, there is a place called Yester Castle, and at the foot of Yester Castle, the Goblin Hall.
Yeah.
The Hall of the Goblin.
I'm looking forward to this because I used to work as a very baby bank clerk in Gifford, beside the Goblin Hall, beside the hotel that's called the Goblin Hall.
Stayed there.
And it's a mythical place that at the time was, when I was a little bit younger, it was barred off. Nobody got into it because somebody decreed it was dangerous, you know, health and safety stuff. So I've never been in it, but you've managed it.
Yeah, no, it's got a rib vaulted ceiling. There's another passageway that goes deep, deep down towards a well. Fantastic place. I went there with a storyteller. But you were in the Western Isles last week.
Yeah, I was doing a few stories out there, but I came across Shona Morrison, and she's trying to improve a very rare nature reserve for an even stranger bird.
We're at Loch Sheppavat in Ness.
And it's a pretty unique place, it's specialised.
Yes, it is. This is the only local nature reserve in the Outer Hebrides. And there's an SSSI as well.
And so it's pretty blustery, it's pretty blowy, but
yes,
no change there. What are we seeing at the moment?
It's quite a quiet loch at the moment, but on the further side, you should be able to see Hooper Swans if you focus.
And there were some geese came in a minute ago as well.
Yeah, there's some grey-like geese coming and some hooded crows flying about.
But this is corncrete country.
It is, yes. Yeah, the corncrakes love it here. This is a recovery area for the corncrakes.
Why is it so special for corncrake?
It's special for them because the vegetation grows to, well, higher than 20 centimetres, and they don't tend to be disturbed by much here. They just seem to love it. There's plenty of vegetation as well for that attracts insects, and they can use insects obviously to feed their chicks.
Yeah, but there must be, you can get that kind of habitat anywhere. There must be something about crofting that attracts them.
Yeah, I think it's just a method of crofting up here. It's quite low intensive. They hardly use any fertilisers or pesticides up here, and a lot of our crofters know as well to cut in a corncrake friendly manner as well. So
this is when you start in the middle and work out rather
that's
than...
That's right, so you don't trap the chicks and the birds and the nests in the centre.
Because that was quite a big change, because traditionally you start on the outside and you corralled them in the middle till the sticky end.
Yeah, that wasn't too fair on the birds. They actually had no chance whatsoever.
But you're also spreading horse muck around. What's all that about?
Yeah, we're getting some horse muck and spreading it on some of the crofts, and what this does is it makes the ground nutrient rich for nitrogen to go into the ground, and if the nettles come up, and because that's what the nettles love, and we're encouraging crofters to have nettles in their crofts because that's what the corncrakes love.
Is that for cover, or are they eating the seeds? Or?
Yeah, it's for both actually. So they use it for cover, they use nettles for cover from moving about, and it's an element of protection as well from other sheep or any alligators round about, and they use the insects for feeding their chicks as well and themselves.
But you're also planting other things.
Yes, we are. We've got some yellow flag iris. We've got 3,000 of them delivered recently, so they're plugs.
That's a lot of plugs.
It is, yes. So we need a lot of people to help us, and we've been lucky enough that people have been fantastic, and we've got some good volunteers.
Well, why the iris? What do they do?
The yellow flag iris, again, they grow quite early on, so they provide ideal early cover for the corncrakes. And the corncakes can move quite easily amongst them as well, so they love the yellow flag iris.
It's a bit early days yet, but are you confident you can get the numbers up?
I would like to say yes to that. Yeah, if we're working on improving their habitat, you know, when they arrive, I mean, there's nothing we can do between Africa and here. When they arrive here, you know, we need to provide that early cover for them for protection.
How do you keep track of the numbers? Because, I mean, I've done this for many years, and I've heard them loads of times. I've never seen one.
Yes, so I do my surveys through the summertime between mid-May and July, and we actually survey them between midnight and 3 a.m. Apparently that's when they're at their most vocal.
Noisiest.
Yeah. And so we just drive around, and whenever we hear one call, I stop, take a note of it, and that's that. It's quite challenging, really, when you have to.
Do people want concrete here? Because there is a school of thought that it's the most irritating call in the world.
Yes. It's not the nicest, to be honest.
Well, it's got a certain charm.
It does, yes, for some. I mean, I think a lot of people maybe, when they're young, they're like, oh, I hate the noise, it keeps us awake at night. But now they're actually not here. People are going, oh, we miss them. You know, they remind us of the kind of warm summer nights and when we were kids, and it's very strange they're not here anymore. I think that now they're not here, I think people are missing
them. Because it is one of those kind of iconic calls of summer.
Of the Hebridean summer. Yeah, it is, actually, yeah. Definitely.
So when do you expect them back?
Expect them back at the end of April, beginning of May. Last year was quite cold, so they're a wee bit later in arriving, certainly up in nests anyway.
So in the meantime, you've got muck to spread?
Muck to spread.
And irises to plant?
Irises to plant, yes, plenty. We'd actually get the school involved as well with planting the iris, as well as volunteers. So
it's just fun all the way, isn't it?
It is, you know. We just need the sunshine now.
The concrete warden of Ness, Shona Morrison there.
Great stuff, Noah Morgan. It was such a miserable day. Horizontal hailstones in the knees, planting these iris for the benefit of the concrete. But we've touched on this before, it's a really irritating sound. But for many, it's as Shona was saying, it's a lovely memory.
Yeah, people get very excited about concrete. Yeah, no, just it sounds like somebody rubbing their nail down the side of a plastic comb.
Yeah, and it goes on all night.
Well, bear in mind, this is supposedly in the Western Isles. This is a very rare bird. My neighbour, Hamish, a few years ago says, oh, when they found a corncrake in my back field. And I said, no, they can't have found a corncrake. She said, they did. I said, no. So he went and got a cassette and he put it in this beatbox thing that he had, in the cassette player, stuck it in, played it, and it was the sound of a corncrake.
Yeah.
And Aberdeen University came out, and bear in mind, his field's probably about 12, 13 acres, and it was, you know, waist-high grass at the time. They found it.
Right.
Really extraordinary. They
well,
found
it used to be quite widespread in Scotland, and they still should be, but its modern agricultural methods aren't particularly beneficial for corncrakes because they need that cover when they arrive.
Yes.
And, you know, in most big fields, certainly in our part of the world, that cover's not there.
I can't remember how they were, because they were talking about actually mowing the grass, you know, cutting the hay in the Western Isles, and I think the logic was that you started in the middle.
You start in the middle,
and you worked outwards.
What happened before was that traditionally you start at the outside, corralling the corncrakes till that very last cut, and corncrakes no more.
We've talked a lot about trees on this podcast recently. A few weeks ago, I was talking to a chap about woodlands.co.uk, which is an organisation that sells little plots of woodland, which we kind of both fancy.
Yeah, quite fancy that. If it was one really close to my house, I would think about it, because it's about the price of a car, and presumably
it's got a river running through
and
it.
And a lot more pleasure.
Yeah, well, a lot less hassle. But there's an initiative in Edinburgh, something you call Tree Time, where you can either donate to improve the care of existing trees in the city, or if you're really feeling flush, you can get a new tree planted on a street, but that is pricey. A listener got in touch with us to say, there's this organisation, have a shifty at it, but the donations are hefty. I went along to Sawdon Park in Edinburgh to meet Richard Dark, project manager.
We've got the Tree Time partnership here, and it's an example here of someone that's actually donated to this tree. So what they've done is they've actually left a dedication on this tree. So they sponsored this tree, sort of adopting it. And then with that money that they've actually donated, we've actually then been able to actually plant some new trees just on the main road just behind the park. These are all local authority public trees. All the trees that are up for adoption are all part of City of Edinburgh Council's tree list of ownership. So they're responsible for sort of obviously looking after it. So what we have is, if people wanted to donate, the idea is that you donate it for up to 10 years, because obviously after 10 years you need to assess the tree, check to make sure that it's still in good condition, and if that's something that they want to do. So we obviously try and get in touch with the people that made the initial donation and said, what would you like to do after 10 years?
It's interesting because Glasgow's got, you know, the moniker of the dear green place, but actually Edinburgh has got more green spaces than Glasgow does pro rata. Trees are an important part of that. Are they under threat?
They are, yes. I mean, we've got lots and lots of trees, over 700,000 currently, which is always sort of changing. And the trees were actually put in during Victorian times. So a lot of these trees are actually coming to naturally to the end of their sort of lives. So, you know, they're starting to fail and just get old. I mean, they're having to have a lot of maintenance. So eventually they will need to be replaced. So it's having that programme of replacement to make sure that these wonderful parks that were built in the Victorian times are actually still as they were when they were originally sort of designed.
I've got actually a piece of paper here. There we go. Suggested donation, Edinburgh Trees, donate towards more tree planting and improved care of trees across Edinburgh, £20. It's £100. And then £200 to £5,000. Donate towards a new tree to be planted on a street. What on earth costs £5,000 to plant a tree?
One of the big issues that we have is that a lot of the street trees, they're on main pavements. So a lot of the times that when they were originally put in, the tree pits were very small. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of utilities that are underneath. So actually what you're having to do is do a lot of groundwork to be able to actually make sure that the tree will survive, because a lot of the tree pits were just, they weren't really designed for actually having that tree to last a long time. So it's mostly actually the groundwork.
You can't actually dig an old tree out, in other words, stick a new one in and not wipe out somebody's super fast broadband.
Well, that's the idea. You need to obviously make sure that all those things are actually done, because a lot of the time at the moment, when a tree fails, it'll just get chopped off at the stump. And so you might sort of wander around and actually see quite a lot of just stumps, because they've actually not had the money to be able to actually dig them out and then replace them. Because actually taking out an old stump is actually quite a lot of work as well. It makes it a lot more complicated, which is why they've not been replaced in the past.
What about the types of trees you're replacing? I would imagine, you know, you've, like everywhere else in Scotland, you've got problems with Dutch elm disease here. So
Yes. Are
you replacing them with elms, or are
No.
you picking something else?
No, we work with the local authority to decide what types of species. So we've always said the right tree in the right location. Bearing in mind, a lot of the ideas are actually trying to replace into streets. So therefore, you don't want it to get too big, too high. We actually try and have a variety of trees. Quite often, you'll see that a lot of the avenues that currently have trees, they're all the same types of trees. So the problem is, if that actually were to get some kind of disease or something like that, then it could potentially wipe out the whole section. So what we want to do is replace it with similar trees that look similar. So a lot of it's to do with not just sort of, but actually how the aspect of the streets, making sure that they, you know, you don't get a species, you know, that's going to be huge compared to all the rest of the trees that are actually. And it obviously leads to, as the roots get larger as well, it can cause a lot of problems with the pavements. So the idea is, you try and get the species native. They're all native. We always want to make sure that we actually have native species as well that are actually replaced.
And when you're talking about replacing a tree, I mean, you're taking out something that's, I don't know, maybe 3 foot diameter at the base, 4 foot diameter at the base. You're taking out a mature, well-established tree. What are you replacing it with?
You can only really replace it for ones that are about sort of between 3 metres, maybe 4 metres high, because you just can't physically, it's very difficult to get a huge mature tree, you know, the logistics of it and getting it, you know, a lot of them are well established. So a lot of the nurseries,
it's expensive
too. A lot of the nurseries that we get it from will all have just to up to a certain size. They're the same sort of types of trees that we'll see in parks as well. Those sort of, there's a sort of standard size, they call them standard trees. People have got a passion for trees. People actually like to see trees. And our whole thing is actually, it's for the future generations that we need to have these trees replaced. Or, you know, we're going to just end up losing more and more and more. And given, you know, especially with the pollution levels, the CO2 levels, flooding in certain places, you know, all these trees will actually do make a lot of prevention in the long term, given the sort of the climate emergency that we're currently in.
Is the object of the exercise here to stand still, or do you want to progress in terms of the number of trees?
No, I mean, at the moment, our sort of priority is to try and replace the existing, you know, trees that have been lost, you know, so there's existing sites where there used to be trees and we want to replace them. But ultimately, what we'd want to see is actually more street trees going into streets which currently maybe don't actually have any. So that's the sort of the probably the next step. I mean, one of the ambitions of the council at the moment is they've just announced the Million Tree City. So at the moment, as I said, you know, we've got over 700,000 trees. And the idea is by 2030, they actually want to have 1 million trees. So it's going to have quite a big combined effort on everybody.
If it's going to happen.
If it's going to happen. So, you know, that'll go from sort of small woodland creations. But being a city, there's not that many spaces to be able to create woodlands. So you're really actually having to try and put trees back into parks, back into streets, to really make that benefit. It's an ambitious target, but I think if everybody collects together, partnership working through tree time, then, you know, it's a good mechanism for people to actually try and reach that target.
Richard Dark, project manager at Tree Time there. Now, I mean, $5,000 sounds like an awful lot of money, but if you happen to dig up the road and coordinate with telecommunications and water and sewage and everything else, you can understand it to a certain extent.
Yeah, but it makes such a transformational way of people's lives. Because we're really lucky where we broadcast with the BBC in the northeast. We've got beech trees, we've got yew trees, we've got rowans, and it's lovely. It just makes the world a better place. And certainly many, many places in Scotland, many towns in Scotland, are pretty blessed with a huge amount of trees.
Yeah. Having said that, it's only going to be a matter of time before somebody suggests cutting them down because they're untidy and put leaves in the garden.
Well, worse than that, there were some councils in England cutting down the chestnut trees because people had the health and safety danger of a chestnut falling on them. And they were cutting down other ones because children had the audacity to climb them. And obviously that was a big risk as well. And the other one, they were cutting down the trees because, shock horror, birds were nesting in the trees.
Oh, yeah.
And droppings going onto the ground, and a serious health hazard for anybody walking past.
What was it? Oxford University recently netted their trees?
Yeah.
Again, I thought they'd given up on that last year.
We regularly ask people to get in touch, tell us what they think of the programme, and where they listen, no matter where they are in the world.
Well, Joe Militello got in contact with us at our email address, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Joe says, I love your podcast, boys. It rekindles many happy memories for me. I love to listen from my home in Big Sky, Montana, in the northern Rocky Mountains.
Okie dokie. And he goes on, my first trip to Scotland was a 2016 hike up the Spey from Elgin to Aviemore, then over to Malfour Estate, Glengorm Castle. Trip two was hiking the West Highland Way and then a few days hiking on Skye. Trip three last August was hiking in Glencoe and Glenettiff, a trip through Skye and then hiking in the Torren and Lochmarie region with a stop at Culloden on the way back. You're beginning to feel inadequate. I am.
It reminds me of a trip I was in Montana. Talking about a kind of different approach because we have a right to roam here in Scotland. Yeah. You can go anywhere you want within certain limitations. And there was a sign up at the bottom of this Box Canyon. Uh-huh. Trespassers will be shot and survivors will be shot again. Welcome to Montana.
I'm sure Joe's not like that at all. That was Joe Militello from Montana, and he adds, I truly love the Highlands and daydream of them constantly. Ah, oh, fair enough. Armadale and Calderwood Park became West Lothian's first country park in 1969. It covers quite a large area. It's got a very active group of volunteers. I spoke to former president of the Ramblers Association, Ben Dolphin, who's ranger for the park, and I met up with him, and Stuart Appleyard, who's chair of the local Friends group.
If you want to think of it in shape, it's linear. Imagine a capital Y turned upside down. It's quite narrow. It follows the river valley of the River Almond. And you can walk from one end of this country park to the other. It's about 5 kilometres, traffic-free, all along the river. You can go from the Almond Estate into the Calderwood Estate, which is West Lothian's largest remnant stand of ancient woodland. It's a triple SI. It's a plateau that's bordered by Linhouse Water and Mewiston Water. A very wild place and quite a contrast to sort of the policy-type estate that Armandale is.
It's a real mixture of sort of trees and plants and things there. You know, the trees themselves are kind of witchy. There's lots of witches' nests in them. These sudden explosions of branches that you actually get on boles and things. Daffodils are just about through. Snowdrops are more or less past. What looked like wild garlic back there, there's a lot of stuff.
Well, it's good for that, isn't it, Stuart?
It's absolutely. As you go through the park, the whole side of the valley is actually covered with the wild garlic. We've been increasing the number of snowdrops, trying to create a snowdrop walk. And in actual fact, we've got quite a long season for the snowdrops because the sun hits different bits of the valley at different times.
Just looking at the woodland, I mean, it is mature woodland, which is wonderful in one sense and not so good in another, because when you've had high winds, as we've had recently, stuff comes down.
Yes, absolutely. The tree there, the chestnut tree, came down. It was actually cut down a couple of weeks ago because it kept on shedding branches in the high winds.
Right.
Further in the park, there is actually a tree down at the moment, one of our large beech trees, a good couple of hundred years old, and we tend to lose one every bad winter.
That's a really dramatic bit of river down there. Can we just come round the corner and have a shifty at it, because you can hear the river is in spate. It's like hot chocolate running at the moment.
It's very brown, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is the Almond. It's 28 miles long and it rises near Schotts out in the west, and it goes all the way down to Crammond. It's the nature of a lot of these estates, though, isn't it, that people did tweak the landscape to suit their needs, and as status symbols and putting follies and bridges. There's a lot of those hidden around here. And Armandale is generally a very good place for bridges. Anyway, we're just walking along the Naismith Bridge here, which was designed by Alexander Naismith. Painted that famous portrait of Robbie Burns.
Indeed.
In the portrait gallery.
On top of that, we're on the Sustrans Route 75, and as part of that, we're actually putting in a new heritage trail that goes along Route 75 and takes in all the bridges that are on the site.
You're chair of the local friends group. Why does this park need friends? What do friends do?
We've been going for 7 or 8 years, and the friends group really is there to support West Lothian Council Parks and Woodlands team to maintain the park and to create an environment that's inclusive for everybody.
Okay.
So we do have
a
lot of dog walkers, we do have runners, we do have cyclists, we do have horse riders, and that we provide help maintain that facility for all of them.
The local people who use these parks are the ones who know it best. Stuart knows his park much better than I could ever hope to know it, and all the friends bring that local knowledge to it, so it's good to have them having input into what they want to see in their park and how they'd like to see it develop. So I think it's a friends groups are a good model in that sense.
Yeah. This bit is quite interesting. This is a Widow Spile. We got a grant from Forth Rivers Trust, the River Life Project, and it's really where the river and dog walkers have eroded the bank away a bit. And it's a natural willow barrier.
So you basically just drove in the willow stakes and then somebody wove these willow withies in amongst it, and then you backfilled it with hardcore.
Yes, and it is living because, as you can see, it's sprouting. So we do have roots, so therefore the roots will stabilise the bank. So over the next couple of years we'll see that as being really a stable bank, and the river will wash by it.
You know, it crosses my mind. I have no recall of ever being down here before. Every so often you just catch sight of something off to the right or the left or something, and you described it as a linear route for a start, but it's full of interest, this.
Yeah, there's lots of sort of offshoots and small burns going off. It's like a lot of the landscape around here, around Livingston, in that a lot of it's hidden from view down in these sort of these low, broad glens. And I think a lot of people are surprised that this is here. It's very popular with locals. People use it as an active travel route. But when people do come down here, they're surprised to find that there's this length of a feature here with so much interest, historic trees, wildlife, and surprisingly wild places as well.
We're just about to walk on to the canal aqueduct. The water comes in further up the Almond, goes along for 2 or 3 miles before feeding into the Union Canal. So it's really there as a topping up service.
It's a Victorian iron structure, painted green in places. We're walking on, you know, the sort of metal surface, but underneath that metal surface is where the water actually runs.
So there's a iron trough underneath the bridge that takes the water over the river.
Okay.
And it's actually designed as a mimic of the Shropshire iron bridge.
Yes.
Yeah, so this is meant to look like it.
It was vaguely familiar.
Yes, upstream is the Camps Viaduct. Uh-huh. It was built for the shale industry. It's single line track for the railway to take goods to and from the oil works and the mine. 23 metres high, got 9 different spans. So, as you can see, looking up the river, it's quite an impressive structure.
There's a right of way going over the top of it now.
How did that happen?
Well, people walking between two places, and it's been used in constant use for over 20 years. So, yeah.
That's good enough.
That's good enough.
Yeah.
So starting at the north end of the park, the Nelson Mandela Suspension Bridge by the Visitor Centre, you can walk all the way through Ours, all the way through the Calderwood Estate as well, that section of the estate, and then you can cross under the A71 and walk a further 4 kilometres to Muriston. Total of 9 kilometres by rivers, traffic-free, not crossing any roads whatsoever. It's amazing how far you can walk in Livingston, pretty much.
Yeah.
Just on the edge of Livingston.
Country Park Ranger Ben Dolphin and Stuart Appleyard of the Friends of Armandale and Calderwood Group.
I didn't know that park at all.
It's a lovely wee place, actually.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it's quite, you think of a sort of ravine with a river running through it, but every time you turn, there's little tributaries and things. Oh, what's that? What's that? What's that? You know. So, and you know, that viaduct is magnificent.
Yeah, that's
a beautiful
fantastic
piece of structure.
But as you say, we've got some great green spaces and some great nature reserves. And for many folk, they're just a place to get out, observe nature and relax. But for others, they can be a great source of inspiration for poetry, painting and music. And if you're a musician and feel inspired by such places, there's a competition which has been organised by Fesh Ross, and it could be right up your street, as Fiona Delgatty explains.
Fesh Ross provides opportunities for people of all ages to engage with traditional music and Gaelic culture, but in contemporary contexts.
But you're going out on a bit of a limb this time. You've got a whole new exciting project.
We have a really exciting project. So for a number of years, Fesh Ross has been collaborating with SNH on our Cayley Trail project. We're celebrating 21 years of that project this summer. That's a cultural tourism initiative where we take really high-quality traditional music to places we know visitors will be but might not usually hear it. So that includes national nature reserves. Fesh Ross also commissions new work regularly. So in the past, we've commissioned folk like accordion player John Somerville to write a piece about the voyage of the Hector, a ship that left Ullapool for Nova Scotia. So it's not unusual for us to look at new work inspired by nature and the environment.
Tell me about this specific competition.
So In Tune With Nature is a partnership with SNH and ourselves, and we're inviting musicians to get outdoors and visit 10 national nature reserves across the country. I won't name them all because I'm guaranteed to forget one, but from Shetland all the way down to Dumfries and Galloway, so there's bound to be one fairly close by. And we're inviting people to get outside and be inspired by these landscapes and the natural environment and create new music. It can be instrumental, it might be a song.
What about style? Is it Gaelic?
No, this is open to all genres of music. So although Fesh Ross generally works with traditional musicians, we do that in quite contemporary contexts, and often we see musicians collaborating with musicians of other genres. So this is open to any style of music.
So you can have rap, rock, whatever?
Rap, rock, jazz, classical, folk, you name it, we'd welcome it.
That's a pretty wide field.
It's a very wide field, but we have... I think an amazing lineup of judges to judge the entries. So we have Vic Galloway from the BBC and Jill Maxwell, who's the director of the Scottish Music Centre in Glasgow, and two singer-songwriters, Corinne Polwart, who herself has created work inspired by the Isle of May, and Julie Fowlis. And both Corinne and Julie just now are working on a project inspired by nature called Spell Songs, which is inspired by a book called The Lost Words.
So you've got some pretty heavy hitters.
We do, yeah, I think so.
It must be difficult though. We here, we're at North Keswick. We've got the snow on the mountains. The water is like glass. We've got waders down there. There was a curlew in the background. There's a seal just off the shore here. You've got ducks. Where do you start with someone like that?
It's vast, isn't it? And it is beautiful standing talking to you here. We're inviting people to think about the landscape, but also we're living in a time of climate emergency. Perhaps an artist would like to write a response to that. At Fesh Ross, we work with a lot of freelance musicians. Last year, we contracted about 400 artists to teach on our programmes. And I myself am really conscious about creative mental health. And I think this is a great opportunity for people to get out.
And compose and feel better. How could you not feel better on a day like today?
Well, I certainly feel better on my way into the office, stopping here with you.
But presumably, and this is kind of stating the obvious, a day like today might inspire kind of tranquil thoughts as opposed to a storm. Kind of choice is endless.
The choice is endless, and part of the competition, there's a cash prize of £500 per winning entry across the 10 sites, but the other part of the prize is to get out on those sites with a filmmaker and create a film. So that's going to be interesting, depending on the weather, how atmospheric some of those films might
be. So we're going to be performing these pieces?
We hope so. We're going to look at the 10 winning entries and see what that looks like before we decide on the performance aspect.
It'd be great to go to a nature reserve and see that piece of music composed for that nature reserve.
Absolutely, and some of the thinking behind this competition came about because of our Cayley Trail musicians going to these sites over the last few years, and I've always encouraged them to look for material from that area. It's really inspiring for local people and audiences to connect the music with the language and the landscape and the history and the nature.
But it's a different thing, isn't it, when it's outside? I've only done it a couple of times. I've taken Fiddler down to the beach in Arran. And just being that at one with nature, with that soundtrack of the wildlife in the background, just adds a whole new dimension.
It does. It absolutely does, yeah. I'm a fiddle player myself, and I remember playing the fiddle years ago on a beach and seals literally emerging.
That must be fantastic.
It was very beautiful.
And it's only been open for a couple of days, but you're already getting interest.
Yeah, we launched the competition on Sunday there, and the closing date isn't until the 31st of May, and I've had half a dozen entries already.
Wow.
So that's quite extraordinary. Great to see so much interest in the competition.
So is that just through your website?
All of the information is at nature.scot and Feisrois, F-E-I-S-R-O-I-S, all across our social media platforms.
So is there an age limit?
There's a lower age limit. We're inviting applications from people aged 16 and over, but no upper age limit.
You get a whole CD out of that.
Absolutely. An album in the making.
Fiona Dalgetty, or Dalgetty? Which is it?
I think it's Dalgetty.
All right. Fiona Feisrois, anyway. And that music was from the album The Hector by John Somerville. We spoke about this at the beginning of the podcast, but in the village of Gifford in East Lothian, there is a hotel called the Goblin Ha, or the Hall of the Goblin. It's an intriguing name, so where did it originate? I set off to try and find out with author and storyteller Tim Porteous to a place called Yester Castle. And underneath Yester Castle is where you find the Goblin's Ha.
You can't quite see it yet because it's covered in trees which were planted in the 19th century. But this is a bridge that takes you over the tributary of the river, and very soon you'll start to notice chunks of masonry which herald the arrival of the castle itself. The castle was built on this kind of promontory which was got deep ravines on all sides, hence the bridge. I visited this castle when I was young, and I don't remember how I got there or even who took me. I just have vague memories of running out of it. And then I came back a number of years back to take one of my older daughters about 8 years ago, and I decided not to look at the map, but I knew roughly where it was. And it took us nearly 3 hours getting lost in the wood, and we were at the point of giving up when suddenly we saw the ruins through the trees. And then we thought, well, there's no way we can reach it because the ravine is too deep. And of course my daughter, being adventurous, ran off. Her name's Morven, and she's, Dad, I found a bridge. And of course the bridge took us over, and when we got into Goblin Hall itself, my camera just died immediately, so I got one quick photograph and that was it.
Oh, head up to the castle.
You wonder if this was a natural mound that they built the castle on, or whether it was built up.
Yeah, I suspect a bit of both. There was a kind of Motte and Bailey castle here initially. Yeah, you know, the classic Norman you know, imposition on the landscape. And the castle was part of the Norman settlement of this area. David I, you know, invited these Norman families to settle. Much of this is later. The first part of the castle was mostly pulled down or destroyed in the early 1300s by Robert the Bruce.
Why?
Because his tactic was to capture a castle and then dismantle it so it couldn't become a stronghold of the English.
Okay.
So during the Wars of Independence, when Bruce managed to take the castle, it was kind of, as many castles were, dismembered. And so kind of rebuilt later. However, the Goblin Haw is the part of the castle that dates from the original one that was built in the 1200s.
It's built in a really attractive pink sandstone. Yeah. You see where there has been a tower with Norman arched windows. Where they've carved the faces of the stone, again, it's interesting. It's almost like elephant hide.
Yeah, I'd say they're Gothic, you know. Probably we can debate that.
I wouldn't argue with you.
And you really get a sense of the physical location, the impregnability of the site here. Because look at the, as it goes down to the Gifford Water here.
It's open at both sides, essentially. So you can walk, it's almost like walking through an underpass.
Yeah.
But it drops off, I would say, that's about 80 feet down to the water.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be an easy place to attack.
No.
You wrote a story about this place, which basically, it's playing up the supernatural side of it.
Well, I wrote a story later, yeah, but the, of course one of the famous stories comes from Walter Scott, which was in his poem Marmion, and it tells of King Alexander III coming to this castle to seek the advice and hopefully help of Hugh de Gifford, who was known as the Wizard of Yester, and he had this reputation of being a necromancer and wizard and a magician. And he's got this really vivid, beautiful description of the wizard and the clothes that he wore. And the king came to seek advice, and the wizard himself couldn't give him the advice, but told the king that if he was to, on a moonlit night, go out just beyond where we've walked over the golf course, there is an elf, a demon elf, who he could challenge. And if he was to defeat the elf would tell him about the future, and the elf would appear in the guise of his worst enemy. Now, Alexander at that time thought that would be King Haakon of Norway. And so when he challenged the elf as instructed by the wizard, it wasn't in the guise of King Haakon, but of Edward the First.
Edward Longshanks.
And he thought, what could this mean? Okay. And so he engaged the elf in battle.
See, this is really intriguing, because I kind of had a shape of the castle in my head based on the ruins that you can see there. But it's obviously considerably more extensive than I'd originally thought. This is absolutely massive, if this was all connected.
Yeah, and this would have been later, this bit here would have been kind of later. A lot of the masonry above here is later, up until the 15th century, rebuild. But down below here, and you can actually see the different masonry, if you just you can peer into Goblin Hall.
Can we go into Goblin Hall?
Well, in the years I've been visiting Goblin Hall, there has been a very significant deterioration of its condition, particularly because people are just not respecting it. They're literally, a group of people have pulled some of the masonry from the walls to make fireplaces.
Oh, good grief.
I suspect it's only a matter of time before access to this place will probably be restricted
closed off.
Or closed off completely. Do you want to go down and have a wee peer in?
Just
take care, because it's a bit slippy.
A bit slippy, kind. You know, there's a series of steps here, so we just need your car canny. Wow. And this is the Goblin Hall?
That's Goblin Hall, yeah. We're peering into it, right?
Yeah. So effectively, it is a ribbed ceiling, stone ribs. It's almost like a cathedral roof underneath this ruin. It's a cracking place to actually tell stories.
Yeah,
see this?
And
we're standing essentially in
there
an
many
arched
times.
Doorway. These posts here would have had wooden posts. So you close the door, basically, and then push that right the way across, and there is absolutely no way on God's earth you could shove your way through that, because, I mean, that's essentially about, 8 inches square, probably of an oak bulk. That's serious.
Yeah. Well, if you're practising magic down there, you don't want to be disturbed, do you?
That's true.
Shall we see if we can get in?
Why not? Go on, give it a go.
Right. So although a lot of the masonry is gone now, you see the strength and height of these walls, and this would have been a major courtyard, which would have been part of the rebuilt castle, built over Goblin Hall itself. And there's a kind of little secret entrance, which I'll show you.
Okay, right.
When you look at the architecture of the place, and when you think it was built probably in the late 1200s, in a landscape that had seen very little of this in terms of secular Gothic architecture, no wonder they thought the person who lived here had some kind of magic power.
Yeah.
So here we have a goblin-sized entrance. and the landowners have recently put up these signs, which I think is kind of sensible. You have to be very careful. So, would you like to go first?
Absolutely. No problem. Right.
Duck right down. It's dark. Very dark, as a matter of fact. And I've been in mine shafts that were taller than this. Ah, now I can stand up. What an absolutely fabulous room this is. God, that's wonderful. That's one of the most dramatic sights I've ever seen in Scotland. And the build quality on this is just extraordinary. Wow. There would have been a floor probably above my head. There's a huge chimney breast at one end of this hall. And the blockwork is just stunning. I don't think this was put together by locals. My guess would probably be French. French masons built this.
So here we are in the Goblin Hall itself, and we could just got enough light to see this ribbed, vaulted ceiling, which is a kind of Gothic style. So, you know, it must have been hugely impressive when it was built in the 1200s.
Yeah. Almost supernatural. You know.
It is. It has that feel to it. And the local legend is that Hugh de Gifford, when he was building the stone castle here on the same site as the wooden one had been, that he made a pact with the devil. And in return, the devil gave him the ability to build this castle with labourers being goblins. Now, he banged his staff on the ground. And if you look behind you in that dark recess there, there's stairs. Mm-hmm. And so this is said to have been the tunnel that
led down to hell.
Led down to hell. And then, of course, these goblins started to lay a stairway up from hell, and they came swarming up. And understandably, this was the first magnificent structure that they built, and then built the rest of the castle. And the legend is that if he ever needed any help or any assistance, he would call on the goblins. Hence the term Goblin Hall, Goblin Hall.
Storyteller Tim Porteous at Yester Castle in the Goblin Hall.
Sounds like an incredible place.
It is a cracking place, actually. We'll put some photographs up on the editor's Facebook page and you can have a shifty at them. But, you know, that ribbed, vaulted ceiling is superb. Absolutely superb, but it needs some work. There's definitely
needs
some work.
Get the elves back up.
Get the elves back up. Just slam your staff down on the ground and summon the goblin.
Come on, it's shoddy work now.
Yeah, come on, boys. Crack on.
There's not enough use made of elves.
Yes.
They're sitting down there. What are we going to do? And nobody's calling them up.
No, but exactly. The problem is, elves coming up here, taking our jobs.
Right, but the problem is that you never get the choice to be a wizard when you come to your career's options.
No, that's true.
And if you don't have wizards, then you can't call the elves up, and that's why it's in decay.
See, I don't mean, no personal offence. I think there's actually a height limit for wizards. No, I think wizards tend to be tall and thin.
Are you trying to say when the chubby elves... you've been loading this nonsense email out of doors at bbc.co.uk.
Yeah. Until the next time we produce more of this from all the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for downloading us.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.